Hi, my name is Londe Yusuf.
And my name is Reggie Williams.
And we're the co-founders of Black Film Space. Black Film Space is a grassroots organization dedicated to enhancing the skill sets of Black filmmakers and building a community of creatives. We host events such as screenwriting workshops, panels, mixers, and other events that are designed to support Black content creators.
In the next episode of the Black Film Space podcast, we interview Marissa Crespo. Marissa is an entertainment and business law attorney. We talk with Marissa about LLCs, multiple streams of income, and taking the leap of faith to pivot into your passions. And now, on to our interview. All right, Marissa, thank you so much for joining the Black Film Space podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. So on your website, it says that you represent entertainment content creators. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. So I basically run the gamut of the different types of content creators, from animation artists, literary writers, screenplay writers, teleplay writers, songwriters for, you know, obviously music, as well as fashion designers. So kind of the whole nine. So you think about, you know, creating content, whether it's new media content or any of our traditional media forms, those are the types of artists that I tend to represent.
Okay. And you don't represent actors?
I do. Yes. They're also creating content. Yep. So it wasn't all exclusive there in that answer.
So can you walk us through like a typical trajectory of someone who has ambitious goals of being a multimillionaire creative and how to achieve that?
Oh, wow. I would say, you know, honestly, in being a multimillionaire mogul or creator, regardless of whatever your trajectory is, you kind of want to get started and start small and have small goals that you're building towards, right? And I know by no means am I a multimillionaire, boy, I wish I were. But if I started off, you know, I would deem myself even a content creator, even traveling on this journey as an attorney. So starting out, I had to start small. I had to figure out, what did that even mean to be one? And so in my space, I just had to make sure that I took the time to educate myself and understand the field and industry I wanted to work in. I wanted to understand what types of different roles there were, what type of different, you know, subcategories and subsectors of the profession that seemed to fall in place with what I was interested in. So I would think the same thing for a content creator who's really trying to craft and fine tune their specific art form. So I know in this day and age, everyone wants to be a multi-hyphenate, which I think is great to be hyphenated professional. But at the same time, you know, like, what is your specialty? What is the core? So I feel like to be able to try to master that craft and to hone it takes a lot of, you know, many steps and goals to make it there and to have that trajectory to be that multimillionaire.
Why do you think it's important to have a specialty?
I think nowadays we've shifted into a more heavy service-based industry and one that's specialized in, you know, niche areas or in much more specialized areas. I think it's great to be a generalist, to have a superficial understanding of a lot of different things, to make, you know, connections and cross-functional connections in whatever it is that you do, because that makes you stand out more and builds value, I think, in whatever career you're in. But I also think being specialized in a particular area gives you that specialty in which you can speak from knowledge and expertise. And that's what a lot of employers look for. If you're not looking for an employer, you want to be your own employer, even still, you have to market a certain way where people know where to find you. It's just like any artist who is promoting themselves from a marketing angle. Who is your core audience? How do you know your market? How do you know your customer? You have to, whether you want to or not, sometimes you are defined in certain areas at certain points where your target audience is, and you have to resonate with them. So how do you do that? Well, to do that, you got to have the data to know exactly what you need to know to tailor to the market.
How does one go about getting that data? Is it just like just individual research, or there platforms that one can go to?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people live online, right? So, you know, if you're promoting yourself on social media, you know, on Instagram, on Facebook, Twitter, I mean, you can look at your social media engagement, find your authentic followers. And then from there, you know, take a deep dive look. Are they not only liking your page, but they're also trying to communicate with you and engage with you? that's more of an authentic engagement than just a mere quick like and they move on. They don't even follow you back. At any time you're doing any type of live events, you know, if there's a listserv, you know, that's a beautiful form of data to have. If you can get people's names and email addresses where you can start, you know, marketing email campaigns, that's a great way to continue to promote yourself and be able to have a listserv of people that have attended your prior events or performances that would be willing to create, that would be, you know, part of your fan base. So it's good to know exactly, like, you know, whatever you can get, where they're coming from. And there's also more data analytical tools that are more more specialized, more expensive and whatnot. But really the true government of being able to understand your core audience is to be able to follow them back and engage with them or take a deep dive into the numbers and who they are to understand a little bit better of like where your artistry resonates.
Okay. So you've taken us through what to do at the beginning. What about to get to those larger goals? Like, how does one build towards getting to their larger goals?
I think it's different for everyone. If you want to give me an example of like, give me an example of one, I can kind of like take you through a process that might work for them, right? It's not a science, it's an art to a degree. But do you have like a particular artist in, type of artist in mind?
I guess someone who wants to start a production company.
Okay. So yeah, I would say if you want to start a production company, for starters, what do you want to produce? You know, the minute that you're starting a company and you're inserting yourself into the marketplace in some way, shape, or form, you're building a voice and you're building a brand. So what is your brand? Are you the type of producer that likes to do more socially conscious films, you know, faith-based films? Are you a producer that loves doing thrillers or to kind of flip the typical traditional genres on its head? Whether it's, you know, through changing gender role leads, you know, that's something that you have to think about what you want to put out there. Now, of course, I mean, if you're getting started and you're getting different types of jobs as a freelance production company, you're going to take whatever you can get to kind of get your name out there, right, and start, you know, start marketing your company and what you do and your and building your skill set. But I think once you get to that point where you've started building some credibility within the industry, and now you want to ramp things up and take things to a new level, now you have to start thinking about the types of stories in which you're creating and how you want to brand yourself. I mean, if you look at Jordan Peele and Monkey Paw Productions, the way in which they did it with Get Out, I mean, I don't even think it was meant to be like a true on, you know, it was meant to be seen as like a thriller, but not the way in which, you know, the Oscars had kind of categorized it in a way. So it created an open space for him to insert himself and to be able to flip the narrative the way in which he wanted to, and to kind of create now a genre of films that, you know, can be seen as like a thriller, but it's a new form of thriller. It's tapping into the American psyche. And I think that's brilliant, right? Now we look for his films, you know, what is he going to do with Candyman? Any of us who grew up watching that, you know, we're definitely going to have our eyes on it to see, like, how is he going to, you know, twist the story, or what is he going to do with Candyman's character that takes a deep dive into the American psyche of the, you know, the historical context in which that character came from. So I think for any, you know, filmmakers that are producers that are looking to produce, the people that you connect with as writers and, you know, who you're building as your team and your tribe, I think is even more important too, because as you scale up and elevate, you want to have your close ones by you. I mean, LeBron James is a great example of that with, you know, with his team and what he's built and how they pour into each other, being able to share resources and make sure they can elevate together. So make sure the people that you want to elevate with you, you guys can do it at the right time, and that you guys are in the right space, you know, emotionally, because it's an arduous task of working in entertainment. You know, it's very project-based. It's a lot of hard work. So being able to understand, you know, who you can work with that can actually complement your artistry along with you complementing theirs.
You had mentioned branding. What tips can you offer in regards to branding and marketing as it pertains to copywriting and trademarking?
Copywriting and trademarking are the legal tools to help protect that brand and how you're marketing your particular company. So as I mentioned, you know, the minute that you are kind of putting yourself out into the marketplace, you know, to sell a product or a service, you know, that there in itself, you're creating a trademark. And so you want to be able to protect that mark as much as possible. And it could just be purely the name. You know, you don't have to have this fancy design logo or anything of that nature. Because honestly, the design logo is great. It's cute. It's catchy. But it doesn't mean anything if you can't protect the actual word mark of the name. So I always tell people early on, you know, it's good to invest. A lot of people think it's, you know, crazy expensive. But here's where you don't want to be. I've had clients that work in the film space that took the time to create a logo. They're ready to market. They have a big name behind them, you know, so they want to roll out with their first film under their new production company. And it turns out, boom, they can't because there's another, you know, another production company with the same name in the same space. That's a problem. You know, that's a huge marketing problem. And it's almost like a faux pas. Like, how did you not see that one coming? You know, with Kim Kardashian and the whole kimono situation, I was shocked and appalled that no one in her marketing team who would be the ones that are more well-versed in not, you know, maybe not the legalese of trademarks, but understand maybe, you know, cultural nuances and living in a globalized age. And the fact that she's a globalized brand herself, that kimono would not rub the wrong way in certain cultures. So she ended up having to spend, you know, millions of dollars to go ahead and do new tagging, right? Off the strength that there wasn't due diligence taken in the very beginning. So, you know, trademarking is big in terms of commercializing the brand, which you're creating. Now, in the film space in particular, that's more so if, let's say, your production company is also doing a lot of like merchandising. Like Marvel is a great example of this. Marvel does a lot of merchandising, you know, taking, you know, from toy characters to backpacks, you know, to different types of school supplies off of the superhero names. That's something that's trademarking. But then there's copyright. And copyright is really the crux of the film business. The minute that a writer writes, they've created a copyright. The minute that, you know, a director actually picks up the lens and starts filming, they're, you know, telling that story, they're creating a derivative, right, you know, and contributing to that same copyright in the work. So all of that stuff is what the contracts are meant before, is actually clearing up who is going to own that project from beginning, and who, you know, who has the rights to transfer it over to a larger production company or a network studio or some form of distributor. So the copyrights are big to make sure that you protect, especially now that we are moving more and more to intangible property, right? Not everything is physical property anymore. I mean, pretty soon money's not going to be money that we understand. It's going to be, you know, the Bitcoin currency. We, you know, as we're moving into such a digitized, intangible day and age, you know, protecting that intellectual property is becoming much, much more key because you can actually monetize on it in so many different ways that we don't sometimes even see today. So, you know, for the low cost of what it would be to go ahead and file a copyright at the U.S. Copyright Office, it's worth it for the sake of protecting your work, even if, you know, you haven't monetized on it in the immediacy.
We're talking about taking the leap of faith and how to pivot into your passions. Why do you think some people are afraid to take that leap of faith?
People are afraid to take that leap of faith because they are used to the comfort and also the narrative that they've probably had drilled in their heads by their parents and by society, right? I feel like this. When you think about your passion and you think about profits, people generally see that as mutually exclusive, right? Whether they want to, by default, that's like the default setting. You have to kind of train the brain to think otherwise. Like, why are they mutually exclusive? I can have my passion have a profitability, like it can be profitable. How do I get there? That's called a plan. So in between, you know, the passion, the profits, there's the plan. And then there's something I call the pivot. And the pivot is that point where you've constantly been talking yourself out of making that change and taking the leap of faith because you're like, I need to have steady income. Hell, I'm living in New York City. I'm living in San Francisco. I mean, it's pretty expensive. Or I'm in Atlanta, like either way, you've got bills to pay, right? And so, you know, unlike what most of us were doing for a short period of time, the bills do not do the mannequin challenge. So how do I make sure that I still keep a roof over my head while at the same time gunning forward to take that leap of faith into something that I'm truly passionate about that I would prefer to wake up in the morning and do. That pivot is so key, because what you will find, if some of you guys, and I've been there, that's how I started my firm. I was at a point where I was literally at a great cushiony corporate job at a big law firm, and I was super unhappy. I had great money, but at the same time couldn't even tap into it outside of paying all these bills for, the insurmountable student loans that I accrued, and also, the rent and where I was staying. I couldn't even, have the leisure time of taking a vacation because I was concerned I was going to lose my job because some partner was concerned about all of a sudden what my workload was looking like and how they would even take a vacation. So that pivot point is where you become, you're there when you become less tolerant of your workday and you become less tolerant of the current environment that you're in, to the point that it's almost like you're getting ready to crawl out of your skin and say, I was going to try to plan to leave 2 years from now. Now it went down to a year. Damn, it went down to Friday of this week. You know what? Let me go ahead and start typing up this letter. It's time to go. That's big. That's when you know that you're getting there. Now, that's great to have that pivotal point, but you need to have a plan on top of that, right? Now, sometimes, especially in this day and age, it's hard now to just get jobs that come with health benefits and everything else. These employers are looking to cut benefits wherever they can to cut costs and increase their bottom line. That's their way of increasing their profits. So now we're in a freelance world. So now, you've got to think. And when I talk about, finding your specialty and finding your niche, this is where it becomes key. Because you can be a freelancer and be a generalist and do whatever you can, and that's what you need to do sometimes to pay the bills, but it's not going to satisfy you. You'll find your passion. You're going to kick off and run even stronger, I feel, if you're able to find that area where, okay, I'm in my lane. I'm in my pocket. People know me this way. They come to me for advice in this area where they deem I have expertise or some type of specialty. And that plan, that ability to market from that angle, that's going to help offshoot you into the lane where you want to be in and now creating more of a profit in your business. And so the plan is always going to evolve. It's going to change, right? I don't know, Reggie, did you go through that? Did you have those moments where you're like, okay, I definitely need to make a pivot, but I also have to have a plan behind it?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't had a real job in a long time. So I've been living essentially a quote unquote freelance lifestyle for years, but I am at a point in my life where, I'm in my early 30s where I was in my 20s, I felt like I could take more risks. And now, I'm about to be 33. By the time this podcast is released, I will be 33. And my birthday's next week. By the time this podcast comes out, I'll be 33, and I'm starting to feel the pressure, you know what I mean? Because I don't have a lot of money. And I'm okay with that because I love doing what I'm doing, but I just don't want to be where I'm at now 5 years from now or in my 40s. I don't want to be, in the same financial position. Every decision I make, I feel like is very, very important, and I feel like I can't waste my time. So I don't think I'm in that pivot position. I've never really had a regular, a real job, but I do feel the pressure of how do I make money now? You know what I mean? Doing what I love to do, because I could do a million different things. You know what I mean? I could do a million different jobs. I could get a real job, but it's like, how do I do what I love doing and make money within the next 2 years, enough money where I could, have financial freedom. And that's the challenge, because it's like I'm really betting on myself that things are going to take off. And I believe that it can take off, but, I'm not 100% sure it's going to take off in 2 years. But I believe if I stick with it and civilization hasn't collapsed, then I can start making decent money doing what I love doing.
I'll be turning 33 this year myself. And I mean, I'm even in the same boat of, okay, here I am. I have my own practice. I'm doing this full time. When I first started, I still did that dance back and forth of, oh my goodness, I'm starting out on my own. I'm striking out to do what I'm passionate about. I love doing entertainment law. I was doing real estate, you know, so real estate was what I still utilize even to this day, that still, you know, keeps a roof over my head and pays the bills in the commercial space, in the residential context. But it also, it keeps me sharp. It keeps me sharp, but the entertainment is where my passion is. I love working with creatives. I love scaling and growing with them and being able to help protect their works, right? Because I feel like, especially for our melanated folks who are creatives, we need all the protection that we can get, because Hollywood does not care about our cultural story and the way in which we're trying to tell it always. They're looking to own it and then use it as the melanin pop and trend, right? So how do we create that longevity? But yeah, I mean, when I first started, I did that dance constantly. I'm like, oh my goodness, should I just go ahead and close this up? Let me go get a contract job, something, you know, to just pay the bills, because this might be a lot. And I'll tell you, I mean, it's real. You can create a company and call yourself a CEO of that and open up a bank account and all. That sounds all well and good to rattle off at cocktail parties. But truth of the matter is, you know, is the PayPal ringing, baby? Like, is money coming in? You know, and that's the panic that everybody feels. And, you know, like our, you know, some of our parents were in a generation where they actually owned home in their 20s, you know. But, you know, some people have different immigrant stories as well. So, it, you know, I know with my parents, they, you know, they were coming from West Philly and coming from, in Chicago, there was an area called Cabrini Green back in the day, and that's where my father came from, transplant from his family coming from Puerto Rico. And so it was rough, you know, for them. And they were a biracial couple in, you know, the 50s. Say what? You know, so that was tough, you know, even though we're black and brown, no matter. But even between Puerto Ricans and African Americans back then, it was still kind of a thing for them to even be together. So I look at this, they were still able to get together, have a family, have homes, but have a home by the time they were in their 20s, right? And my mother was also coming up working in corporate America during a time where women were not truly accepted to have executive type positions. And so she was in the finance world. And then on top of that, being a black woman from West Philly, say word, you know, like that was, that was enough to blow people's minds of why she was even in the room and wasn't serving coffee. Like that's her narrative. So then I look at it and I'm like, well, they were still able to overcome all of that, right? And still create a balance, to create a beautiful family and great kids that have been able to, you know, something been able to move on and do what we could do. And so fast forward, I feel like even with us, you know, our stories may be different, but our stories are similar to the extent as far as you and I of like, we're trying to figure out, we're in our 30s, you know, some of the things that our parents may have had, we don't have. We have more debt that we may have incurred to be able to live the lifestyle that we have being a freelancer, or, you know, getting a higher education, because it wasn't as costly as it was back then. But now what do we do with that? You know, we're also in a more worldly lifestyle, meaning that it's more secular, we're in globalized. So we can pick up and go anywhere. It's just where it has to make sense for our soul, right? And in our pockets. So, I mean, a lot of us are in that boat, you know, we can fake the funk and act like, you know, we got it, you know, we may have it one day and then, you know, something called fortuna comes in and yeah, it kicks you right out the door and sets you back 6 steps. It's how you're able to kind of pick up and move forward, that tenacity and that drive, that's going to make all the difference. And so, you know, I hate sometimes seeing where a lot of us are at, because that's the anxiety and the angst that you could feel in the air with people of our generation, right? We've got so much promise, but at the same time, we're like, damn, man, but I wake up and I have these struggles of like, you know, I've got this, you know, this loan to pay, student loan, and I've got this rent to pay. I'm still living in an apartment. I want to live in a house at this point. How do I scale up to that? And that's where, like, the plan comes in, right? So when you're making your career choice, especially in entertainment, look, we know it's project-based, right? So you're always looking for the next project to get on, to get put on into something that's more lucrative, and it's a sacrifice. But it doesn't mean that it has to be, right? You know, if you're building a skill set, you've got something to teach. So if you have something to teach, now you can market yourself to universities, to high schools. I mean, there's so many entertainment programs that are popping up all over the place, nonprofits that are tailored and focusing on looking for people who can teach, you know, our youth that are coming up and want to, you know, explore the arts. And unfortunately don't have all those programs in schools anymore, like how we have them. So, I mean, there's a need out there. It's just a matter of like having that action plan and thinking outside the box. And sometimes, you know, you ignoring the programming that you've been fed all your life of like how you're supposed to be working at the same place for 25 years plus, like who does that anymore? You're lucky you're even there for like two. Okay. You know what I mean? And it's like, and if you are, I mean, employers sometimes look at that. If you're at a place for over 2-5 years, they want to see how much you've been promoted. And if you haven't, then they're like, wow, there's a ceiling for you. Like, why did you stay in the same place? Like, do you really have transferable skill sets? So it's a crazy time. But you know what? It's a crazy, beautiful time of reinvention. And that's where we can really create our own and, you know, really strike out on our own narrative to see where we could take it for ourselves and for our collective.
How much do you think one needs to save before taking that leap of faith? Or what would you recommend?
Ooh, I mean, the ideal situation is to try to save up. I really look at your expenses, right? So how much does it cost each month for you to just basically live? Like whatever your rent is, factor that in, gas, to get to and from, or your Metro card, whatever the case may be. Like really do a true assessment of where you're at and where your credit is at. And then think about what business you're trying to get into. Does it entail any type of overhead or any fixed costs that you have to add in? I mean, even down to insurance, you know, to operate in whatever specific field or additional certifications that you're looking to get. And I would say start there. That should be your baseline, but then also give yourself a cushion. You know, I try to give myself a cushion of at least like 20 to 33% more, but that's the ideal situation. We don't always have that option, right? So if you don't, then you have to think, okay, how do I at the same time do whatever I need to do to continue to pay those bills, also save towards my goal? You know, and that could mean realistically, yes, it may look like getting a job in a completely different sector than where you want to originally work, but that's still a plan. What you're creating is a short-term financial plan to kind of build up and save toward the goal in which you're trying to achieve of switching over into something that you want to do, or to even have the funds to get the certifications you may need to get you that job that you're looking for as an artist. And build towards that. So it really, you know, really depends. I would honestly say, you know, really if a financial advisor, someone would tell you, you want to have like 2 years cushion, right? Because when you first get started.
Oh, wow. 2 years.
Yeah. Like they'll tell you like.
I was thinking like 6 months.
Yeah. They'll tell you like a year to 2 years to be on the safe side, right? Because there's so many emergency situations that might creep up, more expensive than you would have realized. And, you know, you're actually expending more costs than what you're bringing in as far as revenue. And that might be like the true ultra conservative response to that, right? But I would say give yourself, go ahead. I would say 6 months, that kind of goes pretty quickly. I would say give yourself at least a year, you know, of like savings to kind of build up. And if you can't get there, just think about it like this. I feel like if you can't get there within a year, then it might not be the right time just yet, right? Because what you don't want to do is jump too fast and too prematurely, and you're just like shooting at the hip trying to figure out if this is going to work or not. And it completely falls apart, and you kind of moved in haste as opposed to like really thinking through, like, if this plan doesn't even work out right now, I've got this backup plan, you know? And so the biggest thing is planning. If you're already thinking, I mean, you might as well think of a plan. You know, you're thinking about how to get out. You're thinking of all these things that really the thoughts that come through first are probably like fears, right? Oh my gosh, you know, I can't do this anymore, but I don't know what I want to do if I leave this, or I have to. It's completely clouding my senses and my sanity, you know? And so it's like all of this angst and like fear that's driving a lot of those initial thoughts, but you've got to kind of like free the mind a little bit to think clearly about those next moves, really.
What are some common mistakes that people make when launching their own business, whether it be as a freelancer, production company, or otherwise?
I think the biggest thing is trying to cut costs. And I mean, where I've seen it is definitely not doing, and of course I'm a lawyer, right? So this is where it sounds like I'm the cheesy lawyer that's doing a plug. But it's not. It's like real talk. I mean, whether you use my services or not, it's real talk. You know, not doing contracts and just kind of doing handshake style deals, like this is going to work out. And then sometimes it's that I don't know how to characterize it, just that greater sense of bliss of rainbows and unicorns, that like everything's gonna be fine, we're not gonna have a falling out, everything's gonna work out just fine. And without having the paperwork of thinking of, hey, what happens if it doesn't? Like all these questions, you know, a lot of the questions that you should ask up front that doesn't get asked, right? It's almost like treating it like in a way of dating, you know, and doing business is like jumping into a relationship, right? But think about it, like who wants to sit down on a Tinder date or whatever it is, that how you got that date? You sit down and they offload all this information, like, yeah, I was recently divorced, have about 2 kids, got child support, and, you know, like, just everything that's going on in their life where you're like, man, like, we didn't even have salad yet. Like, this is a lot. You know, similarly, no one wants to think about, like, okay, cool, so we want to work on a project together. And so, you know, I'll be the producer, you be the director, and, you know, we're gonna shoot this thing. And then I ask, like, okay, so who's determining the talent? Like, how are we shooting this? You know, like all of those creative questions to see if like you guys are creatively in the same lane. And then like, okay, if this doesn't work out, who's going to own the project? You know, if you guys co-wrote it too, who gets to walk away from it or walk away with it? Or is it basically it drops dead there and you guys part ways? Like that stuff has to get spelled out. So a lot of times when I see with freelancers and artists just in general, is just that they think they can take shortcuts and not even think about the contracts that go behind these things or the financial aspects of it too. And just kind of going one day at a time, one step at a time in a very short-sighted manner, which ends up increasing the cost in the long run.
Do you do like third party negotiating? Let's say I wanted to start a production company with somebody, and then we didn't know how we wanted to split it, and we would call a third party to help us negotiate fairly. I don't know what the proper term for that is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as far as... Oh, yeah. I mean, there's... I have done mediation-style okay. services. Yeah. So, like, mediations, if there was a form of a dispute. I actually also am an attorney at Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts in New York and also in Georgia. And so they also have mediation style programs too that they offer, at least in New York, I can say, called Media Art. So they're definitely different facets of that, which I do provide. And then also, I mean, who hires me as their attorney, that's who I represent. That's who I'm ethically bound to advocate for, right? So I always explain that, because even, you know, honestly, some people get confused about this. If I'm the attorney for your production company, that's who I'm the attorney for, not the individual producer. So a lot of times the producer will think like, oh, yeah, you know, my attorney. But when if it comes down to it, let's say your production company, there's basically you and 2 other people that are investing in that company. I represent the company. So if there's a falling out between among the 3 members, I can't represent the 3 that are in the dispute. My main goal is to protect the company. And I know that sounds weird because it's kind of like this creative fiction, right, of this separate body from you, but the company is. So, you know, that's what you want to think about too, is like, as far as who you want to work with or like how you want them to represent you or represent, you know, your company as well. But to answer your question, sure, I do. That's the bulk of what I do, is I negotiate deals, whether it's film deals for distribution or among you know, the creative team, the above line talent. A lot of times I'm representing the production companies, but I also represent writers and actors as well as far as their deals.
But you're representing for that entity rather than like having both parties call you and say, can you help us fairly negotiate this?
Yeah, that's more of a mediation. So that I do, but it's separate from, like, I wouldn't be representing either side. I'm basically the middleman of, like, being the communicator, the legal communicator who effectively says, look, okay, I see both sides here, and kind of try to propose some type of compromise between the parties to get them to, you know, to settle that out.
What was the name of the volunteer company in New York and in Georgia?
It's called Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts.
Can you just elaborate more on what that is?
Yeah, so actually they're nonprofit organizations that provide free legal services or pro bono legal services to artists in their respective communities. So they do have their special intake forms and the intake process to determine whether or not you would qualify to have a pro bono attorney be assigned to your specific matter. So it's a full application process that you can contact to find out more information and what that process is, because they do ask for like some financial information and whatnot to determine if you're eligible. But if you are, and your matter is one that can be represented, you know, under the VLA umbrella, there are attorneys like myself who have signed up and that work within the space that are willing to do and offer pro bono services for those specific matters.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I love it. You know, that was the stuff that I definitely looked for, you know, in the communities too, you know, as far as whether or not you have the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. Like I said, California has one, Georgia has one, New York, Jersey did have one, but unfortunately it folded. I'm really hoping to kind of revamp it. I'm not sure why. I don't know if there just wasn't enough support because New York has such a heavy presence, but it is also, you know, resident specific to a degree too, in some cases. So like you have to be a resident of New York or, you know, Georgia, but that's something they'll go over with you in that intake process. And then what's great too is Cardozo Law School offers an indie film clinic program. And that's basically law students who are looking to become entertainment lawyers who might be taking on your case and to help, you know, with small matters, you know, as far as like contract drafting or copyright questions and things like that too. So it helps groom them. But there's definitely programs that are out there. So even if, you know, because a lot of people think lawyers are expensive, and we can be, but you know, you want to find the right fit of a good lawyer too, like one whose personality also like meshes well with yours to like really take on your matter and like care for your matter, and also is willing to, you know, to work with you. And like I love working with my clients, so I work out, you know, fee structures that are feasible for them, so they don't feel like, you know, Robin Paul to pay Peter type situation or it's hand over fist, but it's actually you know, a fee that they can pay in a payment plan process and still get the work that they need done.
What are some alternative streams of income for creatives to consider?
Yeah. So I was mentioning before, teaching, right? When you're a creative, like, let me ask this question. Why do you like to create?
I like getting lost in the work. I like, I think it's fun. And I'm also at a point where I just would be miserable if I did anything else. But I just think it's fun. Like, it's fun to create a universe. It's fun to express myself, and some of the things that I've gone through in life, or just, you know, get my ideas out. Like, I have so many ideas to be able to put them on paper and eventually on screen. It's just really fun.
And do you see yourself as a screenwriter first, a director first?
Like, yeah. I'm a screenwriter first, then a director.
What is it about writing that drew you to pick up a pen or to, you know, grab a laptop and decide to write? What's driving the underlying purpose of it? I was going to pick on you about it.
No, sorry, please. But, I so much prefer getting interviewed. I want to talk about myself.
I'm like, you know, for this conversation to work, it has to be a conversation. I'm like, you keep asking me questions, but it's going to feel like a straight interview. I'd rather it be a conversation. So
yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I started writing a long time ago, and that really came from a source of pain. I experienced some emotional pain, and I just wanted to get it out and express myself, and then I just kept going from there. Mm.
And so for you, it was cathartic too, just as much of a creative experience. It was almost like an emotional journey and mapping, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, very much.
You also felt like you had a story to tell.
Yeah.
Like, it may not have been your story that you were writing, but you were probably creating characters that were facets of some of the emotions that you were inhibiting, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if writing was where your passion was first, what kind of plans do you have as far as, you know, being a freelance artist out in New York City, you know, trying to elevate and start, you know, creating major profits off of your work? What are some avenues that you're thinking about taking?
Outside of the creative stuff?
It doesn't have to be outside. It could be within.
Well, I would like to, I'd like to start a production company and then make a feature length film and then sell that feature length film independently on the internet. And as well as selling merchandise affiliated with that film. That would be my primary goal. And what, you know, how I believe I could, you know, profit as, off of my creativity.
Got you. And so, okay, so you're going to write this story. What kind of story are you looking to tell and make into a feature film? Is it going to be more of like a creative fiction? Is it,
you know, it's a romantic comedy.
Okay, so you're going to do a romantic comedy. And then as far as the production aspects, how are you looking to kind of like assemble your crew or finance the project?
I'd like to do a crowdfunding campaign.
Okay, cool. And so as far as, let's say with the funding, the crowdfunding, you're not able to secure enough to go ahead and do the full production of the film, or let's say you're able to do it, almost get in the camp, but like you've been able to wrap production, you got actors on there, defer compensation or willing to, you know, to do the work, but now you need the crowdfunding to help with the editing portion and as far as distribution. How are you going to help finance that project, right? Because as an indie filmmaker, that's a lot of like what we have to do is kind of bootstrap it and like figure out along the way of, okay. So, and if you don't have all of the means in your personal bank account, this is where like your question becomes more relevant of like, okay, what else can I do to continue to fund for my project and what I want to do? What other avenues are you able to take as a creative, whether we're in the space or working outside of the space, you know, what kind of freelance jobs can you do to kind of build that revenue?
Oh, there's tons of jobs I could potentially do, but I don't think that for me personally that I have the time to do it, one, nor the passion to see it through. I'm just at a point where it's hard for me to do something unless I'm really into it.
Gotcha.
It's just got to make sense. Like it's got to make sense timing wise if I'm not going to be passionate about it. Like I can't be investing a lot of time into something that isn't going to work towards my long-term goal.
Have you thought about, okay, so let's just put it out there of like just throwing ideas and see if they stick. Now, some of these might be paid opportunities and others may not. Would you be willing to work with a major film festival in their submissions group, you know, reviewing screenplays, reviewing films for selection into the selected festival? So like, let's put like Tribeca, since you're in New York. And it's a non-paid gig, but you have the opportunity to network with other filmmakers. You're under a major umbrella being Tribeca, kind of carry that name and kind of see exactly how they're choosing films. To have a better sense of the marketability factor of what you could do for your type of film. Is that something that would be worth your time?
Hypothetically, yes, but practically no. But like, I could see how that would make sense for other filmmakers to do that. I was also thinking about owning a space, and I know a lot of other filmmakers would like to own their own space, whether it's for their production company, an office, a studio, a loft, those type of things, I think, could generate revenue. Like, I personally couldn't afford a loft right now today, but I was thinking about, okay, what can I do to make that happen? You know, I think one thing for me personally that I've been doing the last year or two is having a mindset of working in groups rather than trying to do everything by myself. And so it's like, okay, how can I own a space with other people and have it make sense and have it be profitable? So what do you think of that?
I mean, owning a space requires capital, right? Having the means to go ahead and purchase it outright if you can. And it's going to be tougher in certain markets than others. I mean, I've seen art spaces and art communities kind of come up in areas like Denver, Colorado is pretty cool, like a different style art community. You know, here I'm based in Atlanta. So like in Atlanta, I'm seeing that a lot too, like these different potential like small art communities that are springing up. Now, in terms of the loft style, I think that's a very cool idea to be able to create a collective of an art community. And this is where real estate and entertainment, in my opinion, intersect. I think over in Jersey and Newark, they have been trying to create art spaces or like near the Newark, New Jersey area where they have rezoned specifically to support arts communities. And so that's where you want to become knowledgeable of like what's going on in your local community. You know, I could talk about real estate from a boring perspective, but like when you really look at it, like the land use and zoning stuff, pay attention to the people that are sitting on those boards and who are showing up at those meetings and the applications that are being submitted for development, because they can completely gentrify your neighborhoods. They can push in a whole different direction of like how you've known that neighborhood, or it could be a creative space that's created for artists like you. Now, as far as your interest in kind of creating that type of lifestyle community and owning, I mean, that requires overhead, because you have to think if you're going to own a real estate space, you got to have the capital investment to go ahead and purchase it outright. If you purchase it, you still got to pay property taxes. And depending on where you selected the property, those county taxes can be pretty steep. So again, it's just doing the research and having a better idea. However, you know, if you have like a nonprofit organization who's looking to invest in a space, I mean, now you've put yourself in a slightly different position. And again, being able to understand like in that particular area, maybe that space that you're looking to acquire, maybe, you know, the county owns it. It's just one of those abandoned type buildings no one wanted to buy, and you're willing to do so and recreate the space. And assuming the local zoning laws and everything permit that space to be turned into a loft, you've got a possible situation there. But again, you just have to think about how much it costs to actually continue to have that space, you know, regarding the property taxes. And then you break that down. If you're going to have artists that are looking to work within that loft space and maybe create, you know, sub work carve outs, you know, there in that particular area, you've got a painter over here, you've got a writer's scribe tribe community that meets in this portion of the building. I mean, you can kind of section it off and create membership fee structures, or, you know, charge if they want to use the space for, you know, private events or any type of exhibition space for their artwork. I mean, there's so many different ways you can get creative with that to make sure that you do build the revenue that you need to go ahead and have the money flow to continue to keep the space, and at the same time funnel some of that money towards your artistry as well.
Yeah, definitely. So would you advise to not lease a space?
I would say, you know, leasing it can be pretty expensive. You're trying to lease a commercial space because you guys are looking to operate a business. It's not like a personal residential lease. Commercial leases are pretty expensive, you know, when you think about how much you have to pay on an annual basis. And they'll break it down like it's, you know, $12 to $17 per square foot. I mean, if you're in New York, that could easily be $17 to $25 per square foot. You know, it can get pretty expensive. So why incur the cost of having to pay to lease, you know, $30,000 a year. It's better to have, nowadays there are all these virtual offices, right? They're actual real physical spaces, but you actually can book when you need the space. You don't have to have that overhead cost every month. Like I do that to keep my costs low and my rates competitive. I have a virtual office in New York and I've got one here in Georgia. I work from home. You know, I only go to the spaces unless I actually am meeting with, you know, clients or we have to do artist signings or anything like that. But quite frankly, I mean, that's the quick, you know, here's how much I have to pay per hour for utilization of the space, as opposed to now I've got this commercial lease for $30,000 and I don't even use the space. That makes no sense. So I would say, you know, it only makes sense if, depending on where you're at in your business. If you are like a full-blown production company, you've got, you know, actual employees on payroll. I mean, you're knocking out projects, a few projects a year, and you've got all that paperwork, you know, the crew, the equipment, everything that you've got to store, then maybe it does make sense to go ahead and lease a space for that period of time, you know, a six-month lease to go ahead and set up your production office to be able to conduct business. And you factor that into the production budget, right? But that's, you know, again, depends on where you're at. If you're starting out as a new filmmaker, it's not going to be the move that you want to make. You want to keep the cost low where you can there. But if you're definitely, you know, scaling up and yes, you're doing, you've got like 2-3 slate films that you're looking to produce within a year, rather than trying to fly everybody everywhere, it might make more sense. I've seen on film sets, they were larger budget productions, but on film sets I've seen where they posted up in a particular town where they rented out a whole entire house and the cast and crew could stay there. So now you cut the cost of, like, you know, the hotel rates, you know, all the per diems, right? Because you can get food for the house. Like it cuts the cost significantly in that sense. So, you know, again, it's just making sure you scale and then you figure out ways to cut those costs. And if you know people who can provide hookups, right? Like, if you know someone who works for Delta Airlines, easy breezy, you don't have to pay all, you know, all this airfare to fly, you know, cast and crew to wherever the location is to shoot, that's coming out of pocket instead it might be travel points that are being utilized. So it's just, you know, being able to be creative, just as much as you're creative on set or on paper, you've got to get creative in project management 101 in production to cut the cost where you can to make it work, you know, to get this project made.
Can an LLC lease a commercial space?
Absolutely, yeah. Now, and in terms of, you know, an LLC or an S corp corporation leasing a space, they're still going to want to see, as far as the landlord goes, they will still likely want to see some financial statements to kind of get a sense of like how the business is doing, and they may want incorporate into the lease something called a personal guarantee. That personal guarantee basically means that you, the individual owner or the individual members of that LLC or shareholders of that corporation, will be personally liable if the business isn't able to come up with the money. So if the business, let's say, you know, has no money and you dissolve it, you're still personally liable to go ahead and pay. So that's, you know, that's big and key. But usually they want to see it, like, do some type of credit background history. Similar to as if you were individually doing it, but it is beneficial to do it under your company, if you're operating business out of that space, so you have that as an expense on your corporate tax return regarding your company. That way you don't have to, you know, let's say you made for the year $50,000 as gross revenue in the LLC, but then your lease itself is like $30,000. You only netted out $20,000 profit, but that also means you pay less to the state, your respective state taxes and federal tax return, because you're not paying off of the gross amount, you're paying off of the net profit of the company. So you do want to track your expenses that's under the business, and that's why it's important to have a separate business account, you know, have a corporate entity that separates you so that way your personal assets aren't up for grab, and you're creating a business profile, a financial profile, so that way if you want to take out, you know, any credit, get a business loan of some sort to help scale your business, you could do so. But even if you go to Wells Fargo, SunTrust, like whichever bank, to open up a business credit card, let's say, for the business, they're still going to check your personal credit history. So, you know, that's why you want to make sure your credit is in good standing, but you want to start building your financial profile for the business. And so anything like rent, you know, you want to pay, or if like you've got the credit card under the business, you're able to get it, that's great, because you can start tracking the business financial history to get to a point where the business is doing well enough that it's got its own financial profile separate from your personal, that you can get, you know, more credit or get a revolving line of credit, let's say, to continue operating your business if you're scaling up that way. So there's something called, I don't know if you've ever heard of Dun & Bradstreet, but there's something called a Dun's number, the D-U, N as in no, S as in Sam. The Dun's number is something, it's free to get it. Go to Dun & Dun & Bradstreet.com. You can Google it to find it. You shouldn't have to pay any money to get it. So you can get a Dun's number in connection with your business account, and you want that. That's how you start tracking. It's almost like the equivalent of the Social Security number of your business outside of the EIN number. What it does is actually track your financial history for the business. So if you are able to get a business credit card or a business loan through any of the banking institutions, and you're making timely payments on those, you know, on those loans and the credit cards, it's building the financial strength and profile of the business itself. So eventually you can get to a point where your personal credit is not getting checked. It's going to be the business profile. So I definitely recommend everybody, when you're setting up a company, get your Dun & Bradstreet number. That's another thing that a lot of us don't even know about. But I think it's good to just have that financial literacy on top of, you know, really educating yourself on the creative space that you're in. Because it's a business at the end of the day. It's all it is. It's all business. I think the financial, like history and the financial literacy is so important that I'm still educating myself on it. So by no means am I a financial advisor, and anything that I've said, you know, during this podcast, that constitute legal advice. You know, I've got to throw that disclaimer out there. at least it's, you know, just little nuggets of knowledge for people to do their research, you know, and get educated.
Are there like general sub leasing laws? If I have an LLC that is leasing a commercial space, is that like a case by case scenario where, you know, I have to talk to the landlord and say, hey, can we sublease this space for, you know, whatever, like a day or whatever?
So you do want, it's going to be guided by the terms of that lease. So commercial leases are different from residential leases in that generally, so each state has their own laws. Some are more tenant-friendly, some are more landlord-friendly. It just depends on which state that you're in. So there's no uniform law in that regard. But generally what you see across the states is that residential leases and commercial leases are treated differently. Residential leases, there's still this underlying assumption that there's unequal bargaining power between the landlord and the residential tenant. That the residential tenant is just, you know, regular Joe Schmo, doesn't always know the nuances of, you know, real estate leasing and all that jazz. Very different from commercial leases in that the assumption by courts is that there are two parties of equal bargaining power can negotiate or understand the terms of whatever it is that they're signing. So you want to negotiate that and like carefully read it or have, you know, an attorney review who's familiar with real estate, actually review the leases so you understand what it is you're getting into. Because generally speaking, in commercial leases, they will try to restrict the use of the space as much as possible from a landlord's perspective. Tenant's perspective, depending on how you're doing business, you want to expand it a little bit. But it's going to come down to not only what the landlord says, but also, you know, the local land use and zoning laws in that respective area where you're leasing the space. Because some areas will not allow you to have, they'll have complete restrictions where the only type of businesses that are allowed in that particular area and zone are, you know, commercial, let's say commercial retail, but not necessarily allowing for car washes or for studio spaces like music spaces. And the thinking behind that, unfortunately, that's why I say it's important to understand like the locale in which you're in is who's running it, is that some counties are very restrictive over entertainment spaces because they don't want it. There's this underlying assumption, sometimes, not always, underlying assumption that having a music space or having a film space is going to cause too much disruption. The hours are not going to be your general 9-to-5 hours. There might be more public danger to the community than good. And so they will say, no, you can't have X type of business located here. For instance, if you are in the music space and you know you're a producer or event manager or event producer who's actually or a promoter who's looking to buy a space or lease a space so that way you could put on local music events, there are so many different types of permitting laws, and it might be very restrictive with your respective landlord for leasing the space, whether or not you can do that. Because what you don't want to have happen is you throw a music release party, something or somebody gets out of hand with another, and next thing you know, there's a shootout. And you weren't even allowed to throw that type of event in that space. Well, now the landlord can not only possibly terminate your lease, but also sue you for any type of damages, property damage that has occurred in the space, as well as, make you liable or wrap you into a lawsuit if they're getting sued by any of the patrons who came to the event and got harmed. So, when it comes to the subleasing laws, those laws are dictated primarily by the respective lease that you have with the landlord and whether or not you can even sublease, because some landlords will say you can, but they'll charge you, $100, $500, whatever, to review the application of the subtenant. And then they'll want to say, okay, well, the subtenant has to have the same credit history that you have. They can put whatever restrictions they have in there, or they just outright say no. So it just really depends. But then you also think about the local laws and what you're trying to do in operating within that space.
How much money should go back into an LLC? And how much should I pay myself? I don't know if that's a question for you or if that's a financial advisor question, but that's something I think people should know.
Yeah, I mean, that's more like a financial advisor, like an accountant, can help with that. But basically, I mean, you can start a company with $25, $100, depending on how the bank, what their requirements are as the opening deposit amount. But in order to like scale the business, is just like what I was saying from a personal standpoint of having a plan and a budget prepared, an estimated cost, so that way you can see how much you need to put into the business. So we can talk about that and kind of distinguishing the company entity from the personal, and being able, like, you could view as a member of the company, if you're an LLC, as the owner, you can transfer your personal funds into that business account to help financially support it. But then, that's part of what you'd want to pay back to yourself when the business is making a profit as well. So, there's no specific dollar amount because everybody's business is different. It may require certain, different types of costs too.
So I wanted to go back to alternative streams of income, because when I asked you, you started asking me questions. Can you just elaborate more on that? Because we talked about real estate, but what other things do you think are out there?
As far as alternative streams of income, I think, you have to get creative. You definitely want to do something that you have a interest in. It may not be something that you're the most passionate about, because you're probably, what you're passionate about is what you're looking for the alternative sources of income to go ahead and support that. But you can still tap into, and I think that's where you have to take the time to think about and break down from a deconstructionist perspective, like, okay, why am I passionate about this thing, this artistry, right? What is it about it? Is it because I love public speaking and being an artist, I can express myself and I have people who engage with what I'm saying through music. Okay, that's a thing. Why not take opportunities to find speaking engagements or to speak about that form of artistry, especially if you have a skill and people identify you with it, you could possibly, you know, teach in that area. And I don't mean like all of a sudden now you're a professor at such and such university, right? But you may, you know, may have an adjunct position that may carry you there. Like screenwriters, I see this where, look, if you're a screenwriter, you have a certain nuanced way of looking at the world and you're putting it on paper and writing to bring it to the forefront, to show your lens. That takes a skill and a craft. And there's specific types of formatting that you have to go through and do, you know, formatting a script. There's a certain beat and structure and emotional character mapping. You have to understand what it is to tell a great story in, you know, a film medium versus television versus, you know, a Netflix or some other streaming service or YouTube, right? Or if you're telling a short story versus a feature, totally different. The beat structures are different because now, you know, you've got a limited amount of space in a short film script to actually consolidate the storyline, but still have those pivotal moments, you know, that you need. So if you as a screenwriter understand that and you're good at that and you've been able to, you know, win awards at festivals for it, why not use that opportunity to build a stream of income for yourself by, you know, acting as a script reader, you know, a script reviewer, a consultant, helping to polish other people's scripts, maybe being a ghostwriter, and helping an established production company or trying to get in the room as a staff writer. Now, I know that's tough, and that's a whole separate conversation, but seeking out those opportunities to continue to hone in on your craft while at the same time getting paid for it. It may not be the most lucrative thing, but it's another revenue stream. I also mentioned, you know, the importance of trademarks and copyrights. So let's say you are of a visual artist. I don't know if you guys may be familiar with Justin Richburg, but he is on Instagram. He actually has done a lot of the illustrations where he used a lot of like hip hop images and kind of, he has a very specific lane and social commentary through his art. Some people agree with it, some people don't. But I've even seen that he actually has found ways to create more marketing opportunities and possible additional streams of income. I know for Childish Gambino's song, was it Feels Like Summer? I think he did the video for like the illustrations. He did that. So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, here he is. He was an artist online. You know, now he's doing comic books. He's telling stories. You know, he's willing to do illustrations for others, you know, for obviously for pay. It's commissioned work, but that's another way that you can make money. And, you know, exercise your copyrights and trademarks. If there's something that you're really good at that you've trademarked or copywritten, you can license it. Licensing is everything. That's great monetary income.
What is licensing exactly?
So licensing, what it basically means is you still own the work, but you're allowing someone else either exclusively, meaning no one else can exploit it, not even you, for a period of time, or non-exclusively means you can also exploit it, but you're giving them the right, or and you're giving others the potential right to commercially exploit that creation for money, you know, for monetary pay. So an example of this would be Rihanna. Okay, she can use her name on apparel. Right. So she's not in the business of, she herself is not in the business of making clothing, making apparel, making lingerie, or making, you know, beauty products like Fenty. Well, she can hire companies who do that and they slap the name Rihanna or Fenty, which she does own or one of her entities owns, onto a product and license that out. So she owns it. But she's licensing it with manufacturers to be able to manufacture the products because they have a certain skill and expertise that can help push that product out. And then they talk about, you know, revenue sharing. So similarly with a film project, once you've got it in the can and you're like, great, I want to go ahead and go out to these festivals, what you're doing is you're potentially talking about a license deal with any distributor. So in some cases, they may want to, you know, own it. You know, let's say Netflix comes to you, you're excited. You're like, oh man, you know, they actually want to take my project. They want to say Netflix original, but they want to own it
as opposed to license it, what that means, then you're giving away your copyright for life. That's different, right? And then you want to make sure that number is a high number. If you're talking about licensing, you can license it to them. You say, yeah, Netflix, you get the first premiere for about, for a streaming service, and we'll do this for a limited term of 18 months. And then after that, they want to renew it. Whatever that deal structure is in the license agreement, they can renew it automatically, or they can renew it, but they've got to pay you X amount to still get the exclusive rights to do so. Or after that term, it becomes non-exclusive, meaning now you can license your film. You still own it, once again, but you can license a film. You've got it with Netflix, but now it's on Hulu. Now it's available, you know, in DVD form on Redbox. You know, like, that's different ways where you see these products actually having a lifespan in different ways, and there's certain windowing opportunities of when you should do that. So that's what a license agreement is. But license agreements are, could be told, everything in the entertainment industry, because that's where you start seeing royalties and residuals. In the music context, for instance, when you hear a song playing at an NBA game, or you hear a song in any commercial, that is sync licensing. That's what songwriters and you know, publishing companies actually make money off of. You know, when they see the residual income, mm-hmm. So that's key, especially now in like films and television. We use music now to help tell the story. It's almost like a separate character that complements the storyline. You know, like, that's where Issa Rae did an amazing job with that with Insecure. She specifically picks, you know, like these, you know, San Francisco Bay artists, or like some, you know, local artists out in California that you may have never heard of, but now she puts them on the map. But when you listen to the song, it's like perfect beat, comedic beat in and of itself, as a breakaway point to transition to whatever happened in that scene, you know, some commentary about that and shifting over to the next scene. So definitely artful way that you could tell stories and make money off of it from licensing opportunities.
Okay. Well, I know you have to go in a minute. So did you want to talk about, like, very briefly, of course, what you do in regards to like documentaries and development?
Yeah. So development in general, or development pertaining to documentaries solely?
Sure. I mean, whatever.
Gotcha. So, I help with development for documentaries. I mean, my specialty is in production legal. So providing production legal services, meaning you want to engage, you know, an attorney as early on in the process as possible. So that way they can help, you know, troubleshoot any issues at the time that you're trying to bring on or assemble the above the line talent team, like your screenwriter, director, producer, and then, you know, build out the production crew and all the contracts that are associated with that to transfer copyrights to your name individually for you to own the project or in your company. But I also, I do help with development, even between writers, you know, like, what kind of agreement do you guys have to establish, like, who's carrying this project, or both of you jointly, and what does that really mean? And I also, with documentaries in particular, helping with like releases that you need. So whether it's interviewee releases, location releases, that's all tied into production, when I say production legal in my mind. But also, you know, helping, I wouldn't claim to be a screenwriter myself. It's something that I was very much interested in. I'm probably more of a producer and visionary at best. But I do understand the importance of emotional character mapping. And so I love reading scripts to help writers, like, just kind of pull their story together. Or I might recommend, like, hey, you should really talk to, you know, a script consultant so we can, you know, shape this up. If you're looking for that type of critique, I don't give unsolicited advice in that regard. Because like I said, I'm not a screenwriter myself. I'm just a legal writer. So, I do that. But in addition to working on documentary films, I work on scripted and unscripted TV shows as well, you know, helping with the production legal paperwork, signing any of your talent, running the whole gambit, as well as the licensing agreements that we were talking about earlier.
All right. Thank you so much, Marissa, for joining us on the Black Film Space podcast. Really appreciate your insight and taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. Where can people find you online on the internet?
I'm not a big social media head, but you can find me on Instagram at Clo, so that's C-L-O underscore entertainment. And you can find my website at www.crespolawoffice.net. Or you can Google Crespo Law Office PC in New York and you'll be able to find me.
All right. Thank you, Marissa. Have a good one.
All right. Thank you. You guys have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Black Film Space podcast. If you're interested in being part of our community and attending events, please visit us at blackfilmspace.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Black Film Space. Subscribe to our email list and podcast. All right, see you soon.